From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. The success of country music has been very lucrative for Buddy Killen. He used to own the largest country music publishing company in America. On today's Fresh Air, Killen tells us how he published Elvis's first hit, Heartbreak Hotel. Also today, growing up Arab American in a small town in upstate New York, we talk with first-time novelist Diana Abu-Jabber. And classical music critic Lloyd Schwartz reviews a new complete collection of recordings by the Trio of the Century. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. President Clinton met with congressional Democrats at the White House today in advance of a Senate vote on his economic plan. Emerging from the meeting, Democrats were confident they have the votes to pass the package of new taxes and spending cuts. NPR's Elizabeth Arnold reports.
Democrats came out of the White House all reading from the same script. Senate Majority Leader George Mitchell emphasized the tough new spending cuts in the plan, and he criticized opponents for failing to offer a credible alternative. Following suit, other members of the congressional leadership accused Republicans of trying to protect the wealthiest Americans, who will feel the bulk of the new taxes in the plan. Republicans have vowed to use the vote for new taxes against senators up for re-election in 1994. They'll offer an amendment to strip the measure of new taxes. Chairman of the Democratic Congressional Campaign Committee, Vic Fazio, says the GOP will also be targeted for their actions.
There are Republicans who are either voting for nothing, which is a real abdication, or are taking approaches that simply add to the burdens of middle-class people who they claim to be protecting, need to be exposed for that.
Debate on the package has begun. A vote is expected this week. I'm Elizabeth Arnold at the White House.
Germany's highest court ruled today that the government has a right to provide German troops for the UN peacekeeping mission in Somalia. The ruling was a victory for Chancellor Helmut Kohl, who's been trying to make the German military more active in UN peacekeeping operations. Kohl's government was sued by the opposition Social Democrats, who say that German military operations abroad are a violation of the country's post-war constitution. The High Court said that Kohl must get parliamentary approval for the mission. The Canadian Senate has approved the North American Free Trade Agreement, which was passed by the Canadian House of Commons 2 weeks ago. Canada has now become the first of the three countries involved to pass the agreement. But as John Hauber reports, there are concerns that the bill was rushed through the Canadian Parliament much too soon.
Prime Minister Brian Mulroney's legacy to the Canadian people was the North American Free Trade Agreement. With a majority of Conservative Party legislators in both houses of Parliament, the bill was passed in almost record time this morning. But opposition senators argued today that it is unwise to pass the bill before the side agreements have been formalized. They also say that in approving NAFTA as is, Canada has lost much, if not all, the leverage for future negotiations. But the outgoing government of Mulroney had to rush NAFTA through Parliament if the Conservatives are to have any chance of winning the next federal election. With more than half of Canadians opposing the agreement, this was the only way for Canada's next Prime Minister, Kim Campbell, to start her government without being generally associated with Mulroney's policies. For National Public Radio, this is John Hauber in Toronto.
The Dow Jones Industrials lost 31 points today to close at 3,466. This is NPR. The Environmental Protection Agency agreed today to ban lead fishing sinkers to head off a lawsuit filed by an environmental group. The sinkers can kill waterfowl, such as swans and geese, if they're ingested, but a ban on lead could affect as many as 60 million anglers in the United States. Environmentalists say the lead weights can easily be replaced by sinkers made from putty-like material or from steel. They say a similar ban imposed in England in 1987 has substantially reduced the loss of swans from lead poisoning. The ban could take effect in 1995. A group of parishioners has ended its year-long occupation of a Catholic church slated for closure in Worcester, Massachusetts. A judge ordered the protesters to leave the church this morning. David Green of member station WBUR reports.
About 40 protesters walked hand-in-hand from St. Joseph's Church this morning, escorted by police. Some sang hymns, others wept. The parishioners began their occupation of St. Joseph's last year after the Worcester Archdiocese announced plans to close the church. The diocese argues the building is unsafe and that repairs are too expensive for the parish. After months of wrangling in court, the diocese obtained an eviction order, electricity and phone lines to the church were cut, and windows began being boarded up. Although protesters left peacefully today, they said they did not go willingly. They vowed to regroup and continue their efforts to save the church. In the meantime, St. Joseph's will be merged with another Worcester parish. For National Public Radio, this is David Green reporting.
A new survey indicates that illegal drug use is becoming a middle-aged vice. The Federal Substance Abuse Survey found that the use of illegal drugs among young adults and teenagers is declining, but not among people 35 and older. Older adults now account for 23% of illegal drug users, compared with just 10% in 1979. I'm Corey Flintoff, NPR News.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross.
Trailer for sale or rent. Rooms to let 50 cents. No phone, no pool, no pets. Ain't got no cigarettes, ah, but 2 hours of pushing broom. Buys a 8x12 4-bit room. I'm a man of means, by no means king of the road.
Back in 1957, when Roger Miller had just gotten out of the Army and was flat broke, he played a few songs for Buddy Killen. Killen signed Miller as a staff songwriter for the fledgling music publishing company Tree International. The decision kicked off Miller's career and later paid off in millions of dollars for the publishing company. Buddy Killen eventually became the owner and CEO of Tree. Tree has been the number one country music publishing company for 2 decades. Killen sold it to CBS Sony in 1989. By the time he sold it, Tree had acquired the rights to an enormous catalog of songs, including Crazy, Okie from Muskogee, Make the World Go Away, Act Naturally, Cryin' Time, and D-I-V-O-R-C-E. In a few minutes, we'll hear the story of how Killen came to publish Elvis's first hit, Heartbreak Hotel. Killen's country music career includes years playing bass at the Grand Ole Opry. He's written a new autobiography called By the Seat of My Pants. I asked him if he thinks Nashville is the closest thing we have today to Tin Pan Alley.
Oh, absolutely. Nashville, it just is, the air is permeated with talent and wonderful ideas for songs and great musicians. They've just migrated there in great numbers. I remember when I came to Nashville, it was very, very small group of people there. Today, I think there's somewhere around 30,000 people in music-related businesses.
I have to say that I understand very little about how the publishing end of the music industry works, and I was hoping you could help me and our listeners understand it a little bit better. What exactly do you own when you own the publishing rights to a song?
Well, the publisher's job is to raise a rock or look behind a bush for that brand new young songwriter that no one else has signed. And then you take him and you work with him, you mold him, you bend him, you shape him until his material is strong enough or fine-tuned enough that you can take it out and get it recorded by the major acts in the recording business. Your job is to develop copyrights. And to develop, to me, a copyright becomes a standard, and then it is really valuable. You can make a lot of money the first time a song is out there, but if you have a song that you develop over a period of years that continues to turn over and over and over and be recorded time after time, then you have built a standard. And when you fill a catalog full of those, then it becomes very, very valuable. That's your job, to go out there and always be on the lookout for those songs. And your job as a publisher is to protect that song, the writer's part and yours. You collect the money, you get it recorded, you get it used in any way that can earn money, and then you pay the writer his part and you keep yours.
Now, how's the money divided between you, the publisher, and the writer?
It's divided 50-50 mostly. The only place it's not divided 50-50 is in print, in sheet music. There's a difference there.
Now, you make how much off of say the sale of a record, where you own the publishing rights to the song? A couple of pennies?
It's up to 6¼ cents, I think, now per record.
Mm-hmm.
When I first started, the maximum amount you could charge was 2 cents, and you were lucky if you got that because the record labels were negotiating with you for less. But today, you get 6¼ cents, and you split that with the writer.
So you have to move a lot of records before you start to see any big profit from one song.
Well, absolutely, from the mechanical standpoint, but you've got to realize that every time one of your songs is played on radio or television, you're also paid for that. You're also paid for the use in movies and all the ancillary uses that you can have on a great song.
So let's back up a little bit. One of the things you do when you're a music publisher is you buy the rights to the song and then you need to get somebody good to record it.
Right.
You actually started off in the business as a song plugger.
Yes. I started off as a musician in the business and worked on the Grand Ole Opry as a bass player. And after I'd been in Nashville about 3 years, I got an opportunity to go to work with a brand new company called Tree Publishing Company. It didn't even have an office or anything. And I talked to Jack Stapp, who was the originator of the company, to buy me a little $50 tape recorder, which I carried around in my car. And every time I would hear of a songwriter or a song, I'd go stick that microphone in the guy's face and say, "Sing it." And I'd learn it from that little tape. And then because I had access as a musician to the big stars on the Grand Ole Opry, I would sing those songs to him and get them recorded. And that's how Tree got started.
So what's a song that you got recorded that way, by singing your version of it to a performer?
Oh, so many through the years. Back in the early days, I would learn just virtually every song that I picked up. And then, of course, you'd get someone else to sing it just with a guitar or a piano. The demos that you have today sound like records. Back in those days, I mean, they were little scratchy things that you had to have the ability to hear through. I was trying to think of one in particular, but it's so many great songs that we had back in those early days. Oh, I May Never Get to Heaven, for instance, song that I wrote with Bill Anderson. I just did this little cheap demo, and it became a number one song.
Who recorded it?
Don Gibson did it.
You want to sing us a chorus? You wrote it.
I did. You don't want me to break in the song right here, do you?
Well, I would, but you don't have to.
The punchline is, "I may never get to heaven, but I once came mighty close." It was a big song. Conway Twitty had a number one record on it. I had probably 70,000-80,000 songs in Tree when I sold it to Sony. And believe me, many of those early ones I learned and went out and sang them to people like Ray Price and Jim Reeves and all the other stars that recorded them in the early days.
So that was one way of doing it. You'd take the songs around and play them for people and get them to record it.
I couldn't afford to get fancy demos. We didn't have any money.
Right. You also eventually had songwriters on staff. You had staff writers who'd write songs for the publishing house.
Many, many, many.
Now, how did that work?
Well, one, you're always on the lookout for a new young talent, and you'd find that person, and you would negotiate with them to come and sign an exclusive writer's contract with you so you could develop him as a singer. Sometimes you'll take one song from a writer, but you'd prefer to have him as an exclusive writer so you can really concentrate on him. You'll spend money on him. You give him advances every week for writing for you. And, of course, you're spending a lot of money on those demos, and you're spending a lot of money getting the songs pitched. So you want to know that if you do that you'll have at least 2, 3 to 5 years of his writing. They negotiate today pretty strongly. They'll come in with that battery of lawyers and a couch full of accountants, and they can really make it tough on you today.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Buddy Killen, and for many years he was the head of Tree Records, which is country music's largest, most successful publishing company. He's written a new memoir called By the Seat of My Pants, My Life in Country Music. We're going to take a break. We'll be right back. This is Fresh Air. Buddy Killen is my guest, the former head of Tree Music Publishing Company and author of the new book, By the Seat of My Pants, My Life in Country Music. Let's talk about one of the early, really big successes you had in music publishing. You bought the song Heartbreak Hotel and got it to Elvis Presley to record. And
right.
As they say, the rest is history. How did you get the song?
I was playing a little club down in Daytona Beach, Florida. The guy couldn't afford to pay us for playing, but he fed us and gave us a place to stay there. And we had fun during the day on the beach, and then we played in his club at night. And during that time, there was a show going on that was produced there by Colonel Tom Parker and promoted by him. And on the show was Hank Snow and Elvis Presley, who was just beginning to make some noise, and a number of other people. May Axton, who lived in Jacksonville, Florida at the time, came up to see the Colonel, and she knew that I was working over at that club, and she came by to see me. And we were talking, and I said, you know, you've written songs for other people. How about writing something for me? I work for a publishing company now. She said, I have one song now. And I said, what's it called? She said, Heartbreak Hotel. I said, who would it be good for? She said, Elvis. So when I got home, there was a little five-minute reel waiting for me, and I took it, and I got it to Bob Neal, who was Elvis's manager, and Elvis was still on Sun Records at the time. About that time, Bob Neal sold the management of Elvis to Colonel Tom Parker. RCA bought his contract from Sun Records, and so I knew that they were moving him over to RCA, so I called Steve Sholes, who was head of A&R there, and I said, Steve, I have a song that I think would be good for Elvis. It's called Heartbreak Hotel. I sent it to him, and he said, great, we'll do it. And the demo was done by a guy named Glenn Reeves, who was singing like Elvis. So Elvis copied it to a T, every note, every nuance. So it was Elvis singing like Glenn Reeves, singing like Elvis, the Heartbreak Hotel that you hear. It was just great. And, of course, it was just a smash when it came out. It just absolutely exploded. And I'd never been around anything like that in my life.
So what was it like for you?
Oh, man. I mean, you know, we'd been struggling along. All of a sudden, you've got the biggest song in the world. Hey, heaven has fallen on me.
Why don't we play it?
Wonderful.
Well, since my baby left me, well, I found a new place to dwell. Well, it's down at the end of Lonely Street, that Heartbreak Hotel where I'll be. I'll be just a lonely baby. Well, I'm so lonely. I'll be just a lonely, I could die. Although it's always crowded, you still can find some room for broken-hearted lovers to cry there in the gloom. I'll be just so lonely, baby. I'll be just so lonely. I'll be so lonely, they could die.
My guest is Buddy Killen, and he published the song Heartbreak Hotel and got the song to Elvis Presley. When you bought the rights to Heartbreak Hotel, did your colleagues think much of it? Did they say, hey, great work, this is a great song, we know it will be a real hit?
No. No, as a matter of fact, I didn't buy it. She gave it to me. Later on, we hadn't even signed contracts, and Elvis's publisher called her and said, we want the song, and we'll put it out. And she said, no, I promised it to Buddy. And I'm going to give it to him. They offered her a $10,000 advance, and she said, no way. But May Axton has integrity, and I've never forgotten that.
Now, you read in your book that there was a company that offered to buy Heartbreak Hotel for $40,000, which must have seemed like an enormous amount at the time. But what happened?
It was more money than I'd ever heard of. Jack Stapp, the president of the company, came to me and he said, we've been offered $40,000 for Heartbreak Hotel. It sure would come in handy. I said, well, you can do what you want to, but if the song goes, so do I. I said, we'll never build a catalog if we sell off the songs piece at a time. And he said, you're absolutely right. So we kept it and went on from there.
Well, I guess that wasn't a mistake. How much do you estimate you made from Heartbreak Hotel?
Millions.
Uh-huh.
Many millions.
Yeah. Must be a good feeling.
I'll take one of those every day.
There's an interesting story, and this is a record-producing story, an interesting story behind one of the records you produced for Joe Tex. Would you tell us the story of producing Skinny Legs and All?
Yeah, I went to Memphis. A friend of mine, Chips Moman, had a studio over there. He later produced Elvis and had done records on so many of the black artists in the 60s and a lot of other hits, too, out of there. Just all kind of hits came out of there. So I decided to take Joe Tex to Memphis. And we did a song called Skinny Legs and All. I took it home, and I couldn't figure out what was wrong with it. I knew it lacked something. So Jerry Wexler, who was head of Atlantic Records, I called him and put the phone up to the little tape recorder and let Jerry hear it. And he said, but it sounds to me like it ought to be a live record. I said, that's it. That's what it is. So I had a guy working for me named Jack Jackson, and I said, go over to the Country Music Hall of Fame, tell a busload of those people there that I would like for them to come down and be a part of a recording session. So he brings about 30, 40 people into the recording studio, and I can't play the tape loud enough for them to hear it because it would be too much of the tape getting back into the audience, the sounds and so forth.
And so there'd be feedback or something.
Yeah, it'd be feedback, and of course it would cover up the reaction of the audience and so forth. So I had them sit out there. I gave them all something to drink, and I said, I tell you what, I'm going to stand behind the glass here, and whatever I do, you do. And I'd overdub some little sounds on there, just little noises myself. When he'd say, Joe Tex would say, who'll take the girl with skinny legs? And I'd say, oh, you're just any kind of noise, like the guy was responding to him. And so when it would come to those things, I would laugh, and the audience would laugh along with me because they could see me laughing. And when I applauded, they would applaud and so forth. We overdubbed them a couple of times to make it sound like more people. Now, here was a country audience of people that came down to the Country Music Hall of Fame who became part of a million-selling record that never heard it. And that was the way it worked.
Right, that's really funny that the enthusiastic response came from people who had no idea what they were responding to.
Right, because it was a rhythm and blues pop hit that they never heard. They never heard it before, probably never heard it after.
Well, why don't we hear it now?
Okay.
Skinny legs, you know that ain't no way to do. You didn't act like that when you had it home behind closed doors. All right. Now you act like you're ashamed of the woman. Don't even want nobody to know she's yours. But that's all right. You just walk on, baby. Huh. And don't you worry about a doggone thing at all. Huh. Because there's some man somewhere who'll take you, baby, skinny legs and all. That's right. Keep on walking, baby. Show you what I'm talking about. Listen to this. Now, who'll take the woman with the skinny legs? Stand right there, baby. I'm going to give you away in a minute. Come on, somebody, please take the lady with the skinny legs.
I don't know.
Now, y'all know the lady with skinny legs got to have somebody, too, now. Will somebody please take
a record produced by my guest, Buddy Killen. Why did you recently sell Tree Music?
It was timing. There was a window that opened. I got more money. I got a greater multiple for my company than anybody ever had or has since.
I don't know what a multiple is.
Well, a multiple of earnings.
Oh, uh-huh.
Tree was a very, very special company. It was a big blue diamond, and it's just so full of all those great songs that there was an opportunity, a window sort of opened up out there that people were willing to pay more for publishing than they'd ever been willing to pay before. So I just felt that my family, my wife is not into the music business, and my daughters were not in the music business, and this was a great opportunity for me to take. The opportunity was there for me to sell the company and enjoy the fruits of my labor, because I had been doing it for so many years. And after all, I guess that's what you build a company for, so you can enjoy.
You sold it to Sony.
Yes.
And for a while you were the CEO of the company, even after it was bought.
Yes, I stayed with them for a couple of years after that. I signed a 5-year contract, but became very, very unhappy with corporate life.
What didn't you like about corporate life?
Well, a lot of things didn't come out the way they were promised, and I started becoming a little unhappy with it. They told me to do as I wanted always. They said, well, do anything you want. But I wanted to get plugged more into the company, and that never occurred. And I don't know, I always knew they were there. When I was, I think it's hard for a man to sell a company that he owned and was always running and then become a part of a greater entity. It's just hard to do, because even though nobody's bothering you, they're there, and you know it sort of subconsciously.
Do you miss music publishing now?
I'm in publishing.
You're still in publishing.
Oh, yeah. I sold, I negotiated out of that contract and started some new companies. I never sold my gospel music companies. I have two very, very large gospel catalogs that I kept. And I started Buddy Killen Music and Killen Songs. And I have a record production company and own recording studios and travel agencies and restaurants and all kinds of things. So I'm pretty diversified.
I guess so.
Yeah.
Is owning the rights to songs a little bit like investing in stocks and bonds? You've got your blue chip songs and your riskier songs. And, you know, some songs will pay off forever. Some songs will pay off big, but just for a short time.
If you're smart with it, there's no better investment than in copyrights. Copyrights will always, if they're good ones, will always maintain a value. They won't fluctuate with today's market. And the more you do with it, the more valuable it becomes. The only way a song loses its value if you don't use it. The more you use it, the more value it starts gaining. So if owning a Heartbreak Hotel is a whole lot, I think, safer than owning a piece of stock in any of the major companies.
Well, Buddy Killen, thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you for having me. I really enjoyed it.
Buddy Killen's new autobiography is called By the Seat of My Pants. Here's a song written by Willie Nelson. The publishing rights were acquired by Tree. The recording is by a great singer who was a friend of Killen's, Patsy Cline. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Crazy, I'm crazy for feeling so lonely. I'm crazy, crazy for feeling so blue. I knew you'd love me as long you wanted, and then someday you'd leave me for somebody new. Worry, why do I?
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Coming up, Diana Abu-Jabir reads from her new novel, Arabian Jazz. The novel is based on her own family. Her father is from the Jordanian desert. Her mother is from Jersey. And classical music critic Lloyd Schwartz reviews a new collection of recordings by the Trio of the Century, the group from the 1920s that included cellist Pablo Casals. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Ann Taylor. On Capitol Hill, the Senate has started debate on an economic plan that Democrats say will cut the nation's deficit by more than $500 billion. Republican lawmakers charge that the plan is tax-heavy, and they plan to offer one that they say cuts the deficit without increasing taxes. NPR's Brian Naylor reports.
The proposal being debated was drafted by Democrats on the Senate Finance Committee, who replaced a House-passed BTU tax with a tax on gasoline and other transportation fuels and increased cuts from Medicare spending. Democrats say their plan will lead to $516 billion in deficit reduction over 5 years. Budget Committee Chairman James Sasser argued senators who want to cut the deficit have no alternative but to support this proposal.
This is the only deficit reduction train leaving the station. And if you have a serious interest in reducing the deficit, then you ought to get on this train.
Debate is expected to last the rest of today and tomorrow, and Democrats are expected to prevail and approve the proposal. This is Brian Naylor at the Capitol.
Also in Washington, a base closing commission is meeting on proposals for military base shutdowns. In its first vote today, seven panel members voted to keep open Alabama's Fort McClellan, a base that the Pentagon had slated for closing. Public officials in the area had argued that to close the facility would cause serious unemployment and that a chemical warfare training center is a one-of-a-kind endeavor. The commission will meet throughout the weekend and send a final report to the White House by the 1st of July. The House, by a one-vote margin today, defeated an attempt to kill plans for a permanently manned space station. NPR's Joe Palca has more on the story.
There have been attempts in the past to kill the space station, but today's vote was the station's closest call. Opponents of the project nearly prevailed with arguments that the space station was too expensive and filled with political pork. But supporters argued that killing the space station would kill America's explorer spirit, and that other countries would certainly pursue space travel if the United States didn't have the vision to. Last week, President Clinton agreed that to save money, the space station needed to be scaled back. Today's vote will let plans for the trimmed-down version of the space station go forward, provided Congress appropriates the money. A vote on the appropriations bill is expected next week, and the space station will face another tough test. On Capitol Hill, I'm Joe Palca reporting.
In Somalia, UN officials have offered a reward for information leading to the capture of fugitive Klan leader General Mohamed Farah Adid. Officials plan to drop leaflets by helicopters with wanted information. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrials moved down nearly 31 points to close at 3,466. This is NPR News. Leaders of Serbia and Croatia have presented their ideas for dividing Bosnia at talks today in Geneva. Bosnia's Muslim president is not attending the meeting, charging that plans under consideration would lead to a breakup of his country. UN diplomat David Owen, whose plan had been turned down by Bosnian Serbs, says while principles of a three-way division have been agreed to by Serbian and Croatian leaders, proposed boundaries are vague. A partition plan is the latest effort to end the 15 months of fighting that have left some 138,000 people dead or missing. Germany's highest court has ruled the Bonn government cannot deploy UN peacekeeping troops without first getting Parliament's approval. However, if the move is backed by the German Parliament, then troops can be sent to Somalia's plan next month. Deidre Berger in Frankfurt has more on the story.
After 23 Pakistani UN soldiers were killed in Somalia, Germany's main opposition party asked the court for an injunction to prevent the deployment of the soldiers. Opposition leaders argued the alleged humanitarian mission was in fact a normal military mission, which violates a German constitutional clause limiting the deployment of German soldiers to Allied territory. The court said it would not issue an injunction because of the damage to German foreign relations if the government reneged on its promise to send soldiers. Earlier today, UN Secretary General Boutros Boutros-Ghali told German leaders in Bonn a backdown by the German government on sending troops would cause manpower problems for the United Nations peacekeeping efforts in Somalia. For National Public Radio, this is Dietrich Bergen, Frankfurt.
According to a new study by the Federal Reserve, economic growth continues to show some expansion. The so-called Beige Book found business activity increasing at a slow to moderate pace, with no signs of increasing inflation. Home sales and construction were both improved along with sales. However, California was one exception, with construction and real estate generally weak there. This is National Public Radio News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. Ethnic identity is an important and often complex subject for many Americans. There's a growing body of literature by authors who are hyphenate Americans. Arabian Jazz is a new semi-autobiographical novel by Diana Abu Jaber. She's Arab American. Her father is half Palestinian, half Jordanian, and grew up in the desert. Her mother is from New Jersey. Her father is Muslim, her mother Irish Catholic. Her parents met at a malt shop near Syracuse University. Her father had always planned to return to Jordan when Diana was 9. The family moved to Amman, but by then her father felt too westernized to stay. The family moved back to Syracuse. Arabian Jazz is about what it's like to be a young woman in an Arab-American family in upstate New York. Let's start with a reading.
What's happening at this section in the novel is that a male cousin has come from the old country. And this is someone that the family has wanted the main character to marry. And he is in their home right now, and he is talking about what his experience has been in the Middle East and his sort of philosophical take on how to look at the Middle Eastern conflicts, especially the Arab-Israeli conflict, and his desire for a kind of peace.
And the two main characters in this scene are the person who you just referred to, and, yes. And the aunt of the two daughters that are the main characters.
That's right. Okay. Another time. Look, I've spent enough semesters in England to learn about how the historians love to cut the world into East and West, chop, chop, to reassure themselves of their superior isolation, right-thinking, etc., etc. In the same way, the Muslims speak of themselves and the infidels. The Jews have their Gentiles. What you hate in this place, you will find in other places. Imagine, if you will, living immersed in endless feuds over kinship, allegiance, and possession, which is what you will find yourself doing in the old country. Our border is an open sore. There is nothing in many hearts and minds now but vengeance and bloodlust. The Arabs call the Jews devils. The Jews call the Arabs animals. They are as obsessed with each other as lovers. Each day on the radio, TV, in the streets, you hear the litany of the enemy's black sins. Injustice is paired with injustice. Tortures are compared. Bombs, kidnappings. The number of women and children killed, each side warring to win the greater moral outrage, the greater injustice, till the war of rhetoric is nearly as painful as that of the flesh. Nasser broke off and looked up to see Fatima standing in the door. What are you saying, my foolish nephew? She said to Nasser. Am I believing my ears? What you are saying about my country, my heart and soul, you who lost the father and brother to these horrors, these enemy? Nasser nodded. Exactly, exactly. I lost them, and for what? I am tired of hating. I have Israeli friends who lost even more. It never stops. It's a game without end. Why shouldn't we be the ones to say stop? It's not any kind of game, Fatima shrieked. Her neck stretched to the cords, straining. I forbid you to use such word in the house of my brother. It's no kind of game, you stupid, stupid boy. For all you lose and you learn nothing. You think you can go just cross the ocean and wipe your hands like the Roman kings? What I care for these people you think are your friends? What of my losses? What of my parents' shame? Driven off the good land and sacred home the father's father built when we were homeless and dying without food, she said, pushing her palms in their faces as if the mark of it was there to be read. Can I buy a bar of American soap and wash these away as you have washed up yourself?
I think what you're getting at in that reading is the sense of why one person would want to kind of get on with things and forget the feuds of the past, and why somebody else can't possibly do that. And,
yes.
And as a matter of fact, we think it would be tragic and wrong
right.
to do that. Was this conflict evident in your family?
Very much so.
How did it break down?
It seemed to fall between generations, like the characters in the book espouse different views. The younger generation, especially the children who are born in this country, seem to have a broader perspective on the politics in the region. And perhaps because they didn't have as immediate or personal of a connection with the sense of loss and catastrophe as the older generation did, they were very much aligned with trying to achieve peace.
So the Arab-Israeli dispute was something that I guess was central in your growing up, one of the discussions that would keep coming up and up again.
Oh, yes.
I bet something else that was really central was your life as a female.
Oh, yes.
And what you could or could not do as a female. You were telling me right before we started our interview that you used to work at community radio stations and you did feminist shows there.
That's right.
So I can only assume that at some point down the line you became a feminist and that which seems to me must have been a pretty strong statement the way it was received in your family.
My father used to say, well, do you think the feminists are right? He wouldn't say what about. He would just sort of pose it as a kind of metaphysical question. And I would sit there in seventh grade and say, yes, absolutely, they're right. And it was early on an issue between us as to what the rights of women were supposed to be. Were we considered equal in a Middle Eastern family to men? And in my family, there were no boys. We didn't have any brothers. So we were raised as kind of surrogate boys, I think. And it was difficult for my father. He treated us in many respects like traditional Arabic girls. In other ways, he was very concerned that we be strong and powerful women of our own right. And he would say to me, make sure that you never depend on anyone for your livelihood. Make sure that you have strong skills of your own. Make sure you develop yourself as a person. So as an individual father, he was very strong and very devoted to his daughters, but still is. And I think that we are strong women, my sisters and I, because of it. And because of all the fighting that we went through. We definitely feuded a lot.
What was the typical fight about?
Oh, well, it could be anything from who would do the laundry to whether we could indeed go out on a date on a particular night. We often wanted to go to friends' houses on sleepover parties, for example. All our friends would do that. This was considered unacceptable. There might be boys in the room. There was no way of monitoring your daughter's behaviors if you weren't actually there to see that. And I think that what we were really struggling about was having our own space and having a way to grow up and put ourselves out in the world to see who we were and speak up for ourselves. And there was a lot of conflict over our ethnic identity. I can remember my father wanting me to take Arabic lessons year after year. And finally, one year I said, I don't want to take these lessons anymore. And he said, how can you not want to learn the language of your ancestors? How can you not want to learn your own language? And I said, I'm not an Arab, I'm an American. And he got so mad. I think that was the angriest I'd ever seen him at me in my life. He stormed out of the room. And that was a kind of emblematic argument for us as I was growing up.
Did your mother want you to take Arabic lessons?
My mother often took the fifth on issues like this. She was very concerned that we respect my father's wishes and that we respect his cultural background. And I think she was aware that the context of America growing up in New York State was so strong that, in fact, our struggle had to be to be concerned with preserving the Arabic culture rather than becoming American, that we would indeed become American, whether we wanted to or not.
My guest is Diana Abu Jaber, author of the new novel Arabian Jazz. We'll be right back. This is Fresh Air.
Thank you.
writer Diana Abu-Jaber is my guest. Because you're very light-skinned and you have light hair and light eyes, and people would think that you didn't look Arab, did people ever say anti-Arab things in your presence, thinking that it wouldn't, you know, it would be okay with you?
Yeah. It, you know, it's very strange, too, because people will say things like that knowing that I am Arabic, that I have an Arabic father. Somehow, if you don't look the part, you are not meant to identify, apparently, with the part. And I have had people say amazing things to me about the family's last name, about, oh, those greedy Arabs. And I've had to listen to a lot of sort of general racist remarks about any kind of Middle Eastern person. And, you know, it's interesting. I can see that my younger sisters are treated somewhat differently than I am.
Because they're darker?
Yeah, yeah.
Different in what ways?
Well, I think that they've had to endure certain kinds of prejudice that sometimes people will ask them, well, what are you anyway, as if you have to be something if you don't look like a white American. My sister said that she's had to try to enlighten people as to why we shouldn't be engaging in things like the Persian Gulf War, for example, because people will hold forth on why this is America and we have to fight this kind of enemy. You know, our struggle is to say, this is what the enemy can look like. The enemy can be very light-skinned, can be pale, can look like all different kinds of things, can look just like you. And what do you do then if you can't personify the enemy in this kind of physical difference? So it's an interesting kind of an issue. And during the Persian Gulf War, I did experience some kinds of, I would say, hidden prejudices. I was called by the CIA in my office and was asked about Arab subversive activities in the community. And when I said I wanted to speak to a lawyer first, I was never contacted again. Our house was broken into and was basically ransacked during the Persian Gulf War. And people wrote anti-Arab slogans on the walls. All kinds of very creepy, eerie kinds of things happened during that time when I think anti-Arab sentiment was very strong and alive. Hmm. Yeah.
I think in a way the point of a novel like yours and of the recent memoirs that have been published about being a quote hyphenate American,
yes,
the point is to be really honest about what it's like and to tell the truth, whether that is offend some people or, you know, make some people uncomfortable, mm-hmm, including people in your own family.
Yes.
Of course, the consequence of that is that you risk offending people in your own family and making
them
uncomfortable.
Yeah.
So how are you coping with that? I'm sure there are going to be people in your family who are uncomfortable with some things you've written.
Yeah, I think that's true. Part of the way I cope with it is to live in Oregon, where most of my family lives in New York.
And so you're on the opposite coast.
That's right. That helps a lot. And my overseas family isn't arriving until next week, by which time I plan to be in Iowa, so I'm going to be far away. But what I really want to do with a novel like this is to try to explore some of these, not secrets, but these stories that we simply don't bring out, that we don't discuss. There's so much in a family that's hidden, that somehow we try to suppress these things in our families, and yet when we do that, they become even more ferocious, even more troublesome. And I think that the way to truly work through them is to express them, to give them life and articulation, and then we can really try to work with it. So that's what I'm going to tell to some of my aunts when they get over here and start asking me about it.
Diana, thank you very much for talking with us.
Oh, you're so welcome.
Diana Abu-Jaber is the author of the new novel Arabian Jazz. She teaches literature and creative writing at the University of Oregon in Eugene. This is Fresh Air. Robert Siegel's with us. Robert, what's coming up on All Things Considered?
Well, we'll be hearing from Brian Naylor about the progress of President Clinton's budget in the U.S. Senate. Also today, you'll be trying to sort out some of the complicated political situations around the world. Sylvia Poggioli is talking to us about the negotiations in Geneva about the future of Bosnia. And we'll also be talking to freelancer Tom Goltz, who's in Baku, the capital of Azerbaijan,
changes in the leadership of that former Soviet republic. And a special report today by Patricia Neiman, who's been covering health care reform for us for quite a while. It's about mental health care and how that'll fit into health care reform, what'll be covered and what won't be covered.
Thanks, Robert. That and more on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. In the late 1920s, the team of pianist Alfred Cortot, violinist Jacques Thibault, and cellist Pablo Casals were called the Trio of the Century. Classical music critic Lloyd Schwartz says this was a very accurate name. The Angel EMI label has just released the first album that includes all the recordings the trio ever made. Lloyd has this review.
Musicians at the beginning of this century seem to have been more interested in music than in merely furthering their solo careers. One reason I have for saying this is that so many of the greatest musicians of that time made such an extensive commitment to chamber music. Maybe they were so great because they were devoted to chamber music. Between 1926 and 1929, some of the central masterpieces in the chamber repertoire were recorded by three musical giants, two Frenchmen, the dazzling pianist Alfred Cortot and the elegant violinist Jacques Thibault, who was killed in a plane crash in 1953, and a Catalonian Spaniard who was one of the world's greatest musicians on any instrument, cellist Pablo Casals. They were a perfect combination because they balanced refinement and energy, witty, almost conversational repartee, and lilting, soaring melody. Listen to the lullaby that opens the slow movement of Schubert's B-flat trio. Cortot, Thibault, and Casals played not only with profound respect for the music, but also with a deep spirit of courtesy, of cooperation, of respect for one another. You can hear this in every phrase. Yet the wonder of chamber music is that the individual participants never have to give up their individuality. Each player has a turn to shine. Each player lets the others shine. Here's the opening of the Mendelssohn Trio in D minor, with its tender song for solo cello. This three-CD set contains the complete recorded collaboration of Cortot, Thibault, and Casals. Besides the Schubert and Mendelssohn we've heard, there are trios by Haydn, Beethoven, and Schumann. Courtauld was a distinguished conductor as well as a pianist, and he leads an extraordinary recording of the Brahms Double Concerto with Thibaud and Casals as the two soloists. There are two duets, Courtauld and Thibaud in their famous rendition of Beethoven's Kreutzer Sonata, and Courtauld and Casals doing Beethoven's Magic Flute Variations. But the heart of this set are the trios. Here's the opening of the delightful finale of Haydn's late sunlit trio in G major. To be said about these supreme performances. They're indispensable models of natural, unmannered, alert, and flawlessly beautiful playing. Nothing is taken for granted. Each note seems to be a discovery. Each phrase is moving towards some greater harmony. These recordings are the absolute standard by which all later performances must be measured.
Lord Schwartz is classical music editor of the Boston Phoenix and is author of the collection of poems Goodnight, Gracie. He reviewed a three-disc set of chamber music performed by Alfred Courtauld, Jacques Thibaud, and Pablo Casals on EMI. Fresh Air senior producer is Danny Miller. Our engineers this week are Joyce Lieberman and Chris Fraley. Roberta Shurak directs the show. I'm Terry Gross.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional grants are provided by the National Endowment for the Arts. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, the Confessions of a Little League Coach. We talk with Bill Geist, a Little League coach and a commentator for CBS Sunday Morning. I'm Terry Gross. I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air.